Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more U-N-I-T-Y. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
That is correct, and some people didn't get that memo about stopping the fussing, the fighting, and doing it right, and I'm talking none other than that fool in the White House, the 34-count felon, the pathological liar, the war criminal, and soon to be discovered a pedophile. So let's just hold on for that. But this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. Compliments of Black Radio Hall of Fame. And so we're not in the studio, but that's still why this is the platform that we're using. So welcome to the show. And I'm going to put some of the events first because we always seem to run out of time. Last week, we had a hell of a weekend, y'all, in St. Louis. And so the Northside Movement Center opened to lots of fanfare. That was exciting. They're going to be on the north side just in time for a real breakthrough with hopefully the tornado recovery process, because there's not been a whole lot of recovery since May of last year, sadly. And only those homeowners or folks who could get it together have seen some progress. We lost Joan Suarez last week.
Can you hear me now? Okay, yeah. So I just won't hear the have this headset, but I was saying we lost Joan Suarez last week, and she is one of the mighty fighters for workers' rights. And for those people who really want to honor her, I am encouraging you to see the last two shows of A Brick and a Bible that's being put on by Bread and Roses. And that Bread and Roses was one of the brainchild of Joan Suarez as she tried to put culture, theater, and workers' rights all together, and she's done a hell of a job. This is going to be the 10th anniversary for Bread and Roses, and so I can't help but think about her without thinking about Bread and Roses. But A Brick and a Bible has two more shows left. It's a phenomenal play that centers on a worker struggle right here in St. Louis, y'all. And I always like to remind people, and this is Women's History Month, the sisters who waged that battle against the Funston Pecan Company did it during the Depression. Now think about that. They said, we ain't working for these pennies anymore. We want a union, and we're gonna leave this job if we have to. That's how powerful they were. And so that has gone down in history and actually helped to spawn a number of other union activities. And so we want to make sure the folks in St. Louis know the history here. It's a powerful story, and it's being brought to you live on stage. So make sure you take note of that. That's going to be on my website at JamalaRogers.com. The other thing I think is just, you know, to remind people that the 46th anniversary of the Organization for Black Struggle is going to be this month. We had to cancel it in January due to the snowstorm, so it's not over. It's coming up, and we'll keep reminding you as we go forward. But today is the first Wednesday of the month. That means it's BlackCommentator.com Wednesday. BC Roundtable is here with us, and our two brothers that are here are Bill Fletcher and David Love. Both of them are contributors to BlackCommentator.com, and they have their own website. But we're just going to dive right into it because there's a lot to talk about. And we were getting into some of that before you came on, Bill, because, well, I want to start with Jesse Jackson, and then because most of us wrote about Jesse Jackson and his legacy BlackCommentator.com. I didn't do it for BlackCommentator.com, but I did write something up. And so I just want to ask you two, what do you think his legacy is right now? It's not like his years since his death? Because sometimes it gets clear what people's legacy is the further out you go. But what would you say his legacy is?
I would say, well thanks, Jamala. Glad to be back, by the way. Congratulations to OBS.
Thank you.
I look at Jackson as really four Jesse Jacksons. And the most important to me was the third one. So the first one was the Operation Breadbasket, working directly with King, Martin Luther King. The second one was when he splits off from Operation Breadbasket and SCLC and sets up Operation Push and gets involved in a lot of fights around, excuse me, Black entrepreneurship. A little bit on historically Black colleges too, but a lot, you know, demanding more franchises, Black franchises from corporations, things like that. The third Jesse Jackson was from 1983 to 1989. And that was, I think, the greatest point in his life and the most significant. I'll come back to that. And then the fourth Jesse Jackson is post-1989, which was him being an orator, developing innovative ideas, but very much being a lone wolf, even though he still had an organization which became Rainbow Push. So to me, the legacy really is what I've been calling the Jackson moment of 83 to 89. And his two presidential campaigns, the building of the Rainbow Coalition, the energy that that sparked, the energy that that was based on coming out of the Black-led electoral upsurge, that to me is, that's a central piece of his legacy.
What about you, David? What's your view?
Well, I had the honor of meeting Reverend Jackson a few times. First, I'll say that he was the first person I voted for president. That was when I was old enough to vote, and I worked on his campaign when I was in college. And in the 90s, when I organized this National Police Brutality Conference, he was the keynote speaker. And he also attended my law school graduation. And I would say that there are a couple of things that come to mind when I think about Reverend Jackson. The first is the difference he made in his presidential run, and I'm thinking specifically, particularly of the second one. And the one thing that I keep remembering is people asking, well, can he win? Can he win? And I think he really expanded possibilities. And looking back at those times, you know, I don't think I really appreciated back then how progressive his ideas were, particularly in today's context. But also, I'm thinking about what he did in terms of negotiating with foreign countries to have Americans released from captivity and things like that. And I'm thinking, you know, you just don't see too many people like that with that ability and forcefulness. So those are some of the things that that come to mind. And, you know, I'm looking at the current landscape and I'm hoping that, you know, there are individuals who could have that forcefulness and, you know, maybe not necessarily play that role, but to really assume the mantle of left and progressive politics and do it, you know, unabashedly.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with the two of you. I think that when I wrote about him, I was channeling Manning Marble, who, even when he wrote about Malcolm X, wrote about the good, bad, and the ugly, and that got him into a bit of some trouble. But I think for the folks, and Bill knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. But I think for our leaders, we have to be real about who they are. We have to humanize them. Otherwise, we're going to deify them. And I don't think that's proper, because it's too far to fall when you mess up. And he made some blunders. And we saw the blunders, some of it in real time. But one of the things I wrote about in my piece is that
he often was viewed as somebody that was seeking the limelight and the cameras and that kind of thing. And I started to think about that when I was writing, and I said, well, was there ever a time, Jamala, that he did that when he wasn't value added? And I couldn't come up with anything. So yes, he would like get a hold of that mic. Yes, he would finagle his way on the stage and all of that. But he had like this amazing mind and the oratory and putting those together. And one of the things I said was like, he was able to take complex concepts and make it into everyday language that, you know, the masses of our people could understand. So that was one thing that I really valued. And at the time of the 88 presidential run, I was a part of the League for Revolutionary Struggle, and I was writing for the newspaper Unity. And so I was sent as the advance for Super Tuesday in the South. So I was traveling through the South ahead of his campaign, seeing how people were going to be responding, seeing how they were working. And that part in and of itself was amazing, how people were responding to Jesse. And then when he would come on the scene, like just magic would happen. And I did think about, to your point, David, his role as an ambassador, as a diplomat that we hadn't seen before, and apparently was able to convince these world leaders of his power and authority. That I had never ever seen that done, where somebody that's just, quote, a citizen goes over and plays that role. So I think there are some moments that definitely are high up there that nobody else has been able to reach. But I always like to say, for the Rainbow Coalition, that was originally the concept of our chairman, Fred Hampton, and Jesse was able to take it to the next level. And unfortunately, nobody's been able to take it to the next level, but that doesn't mean we don't need that Rainbow Coalition. So no. I think we'll be writing about Jesse for some time to come.
I think, Jamala, that, and now I'm stepping into a minefield, because I am quite critical of Jackson. And I'm critical of him because, among other things, he could never succeed in building a leadership team. And you contrast him with Martin Luther King. Just think about it for a second. King surrounded himself with leaders. They were his circle, you know, whether it was Abernathy or Jackson, for that matter. People that had real bases, very intelligent, and he relished having them around and gave them space, and they were all deeply loyal to King. Jackson never did that. Jackson wanted to be the brightest light in the room and was very uncomfortable when he wasn't. Now, some people may get upset for me saying this, but I think that this is very important when we're thinking about leaders. The other thing was the terrible mistake or decision in March of 1989 to turn the Rainbow Coalition into his personal organization. And it was a terrible decision that I would argue we are actually living the ramifications of that. Because the Rainbow Coalition had, as you both know, immense potential to be an alternative political pole around which a lot of progressives could have united. And we were the counter to what eventually became the Tea Party. We were the counter to some of the reactionary currents in the 80s. And when he straitjacketed the organization, that was like stuffing a cannon with rocks.
Bill, do you think some of this has to do with the messiah complex that we see with so many black leadership? I mean, it's an interesting point you made about King. I mean, ironically, J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO managed to annihilate most of our leadership. But do you think that black leadership these days are learning the lesson from that? Because it seems to me that we can't afford to have one person on top, and traditionally it's always been a male figurehead, which is problematic in and of itself. But do you think that we have somehow learned from that and maybe can make way for a broader array of leaders?
David, I think that there were two issues and you've identified one of them. I think that there is a tendency, particularly among men, to look for the great strong man. And when I hear about people that voted for Trump who should never have voted for Trump, I'm talking about people of color, part of it was a real misogynist, real male supremacist thing. So I do think that there's this element of we need a great leader. But I think that there's another piece too, which is the seductiveness of power. There's a metaphor that I use about this. If you ever read the Odyssey by Homer, there's a part in there where Odysseus is heading back to Greece and they have to go by this island, and it was the island of the Sirens. And the Sirens were these women who would sing these beautiful songs, right? And the sailors, they couldn't resist it, and they'd go to try to get, and they'd crash into the rocks and die. So Odysseus says to his sailors, I'm gonna stuff your ears and you're gonna rope me to the ship's mast so I can't get out. And you're to keep rolling. And no matter what I'm yelling out, you keep rowing. We didn't have a mast to tie Jesse Jackson to. And when the ship came close to the Sirens of the Democratic Party establishment, I think it was too difficult to resist. There were people who will go nameless who were definitely working with Vince Jackson that he had a future in the Democratic Party establishment. He had a future as a great leader as long as he shackled the Rainbow Coalition. And what ended up happening was the Rainbow Coalition died a slow death. And then you watch how Jackson was treated by the Democratic Party establishment, beginning with Bill Clinton and the whole Sister Soldier incident. And it's like he made a big miscalculation. Part of that also, a miscalculation, was rooted in, I think, his misreading the 1988 election. I felt all along that he thought a Jackson wing of the Democratic Party had been formed as a result of his campaign. And that's not what happened. He got a huge number of delegates and everything, of course, and the Rainbow Coalition was being built, but there was no Jackson wing. There was nothing comparable to the old Kennedy wing of the Democratic. There wasn't anything like that. And he made a miscalculation, and unfortunately, we've been paying the price.
Well, I think that what we've said today is some raw material that somebody can use to really start writing about the legacy of Jesse, because one of the things I always think about is how do we remember people even with their flaws? And that's what right. is the best way to characterize them? Was it basically positive or basically negative? And he really is a mixed kind of bag, but I think had he come at a different time with a different arrangement of people around him, it might have ended up differently. So, but certainly we learned a lot from what he did in the Rainbow Coalition and what he didn't do, and how to proceed in building a multiracial coalition around a specific agenda. So, you know, speaking of agendas, I think when we look at the agenda of the MAGA folks, and, you know, David and I were talking about this, it's like the world is on fire. Everybody mm-hmm. here is a domestic terrorist, so they're gonna get like what they get. And then everybody outside is a domestic terror. This man has created wars in 8 countries in a year. Unprecedented. I mean, and all of them just happen to be countries where the people are of color. And so just looking at this latest attack on Iran and knowing that Obama had put together some kind of agreement that this fool tore up when he came into office, and then he says they don't want to like negotiate. Well, they had already negotiated. And so every time I hear them, this is why I have to like put them on mute sometimes, because the lies that spew out of their mouths is just unbearable, is like everything he was saying about the leadership of Iran, you could have turned it around and it applied to him. And I'm thinking, fool, what? Are you think we stupid or what? And so I would like for us to really talk about, because some people are saying that all of these like aggressions are distractions for the Epstein files, away from the Epstein files. I think that might have some validity, but I think these folks are trying to ultimately go after people's natural resources and then have hegemony over the oil and energy so that they become more dominant than China. So what's your thoughts around this?
You start, David.
Yeah, well, I think it's possible for this U.S. operation, U.S. and Israeli operation in Iran to be Operation Epstein Files, and for there to be this, you know, imperialist project that's just continuing. I mean, you know, it's no secret that Israel has wanted this forever, and they would like to control the Middle East, so-called Middle East. So I guess it's no surprise. At the same time, you have, you know, the Trump administration run by, you know, Fox News hosts and reality TV show hosts, combination of white mediocrity, incompetence, hubris, and, you know, extremism and white supremacy. I think they are, you know, they're doing what they want to do. And I found it interesting that, you know, the Defense Department, they eliminated a lot of the, you know, so-called DEI in the military. I don't have a dog in that fight because, you know, that's not my thing, military. But I just noted that, you know, they got rid of a lot of the women generals, black generals, folks who might say some things in opposition to what's going on, you know, might not obey illegal orders, things like that. So now they have basically, you know, the white Christian nationalists who were down for Armageddon. And this is what you get. They underestimated Iran. And I by no means am caping for Iran and for, you know, whatever repression they have committed. But I also think that no one has a right to go into other countries and bomb them and control them for the oil. But one thing I will note, I find it interesting, I always do, whenever they come around to bombing a country in the Middle East and trying to take it over, they'll say a number of things, including, oh, well, these people are terrorists. They hate us for our freedom and all those things. No one talks about 1953 when the CIA and the MI6, the British version of the CIA, overthrew the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, because he wanted to control his country's oil and nationalize it. BP didn't appreciate that, so they had to do something about that. And I think that's why we're talking about all of this now. The U.S. just can't keep its hands out of other folks' business. And I think this is not turning out the way the U.S. expected, and I'm here for it.
So, Bill, one of the things that keeps getting talked about is that Trump did not get congressional authorization. It seems ill-planned. He didn't even communicate his plans to the countries that were going to be negatively impacted. So you have all of these airports closed, thousands of people at bay, including Americans, who when they call the local embassy of the country they're stranded in, they get voicemail. And so they get no help whatsoever. So here you have what looks like some kind of spontaneous action that people are talking about, but does that matter if they planned it a day or a year? The fact of it is that people are dying and that that's somebody else's country.
Paula, we're looking at a 15-year-old boy in the body of an 80-year-old man who appears to have cognitive issues. and so his behavior, we can't like root his behavior in rational decision making. There are people around him that have really reactionary thinking. They're not quite irrational, but they're reactionary. I think when we're looking at this, what jumps out at me is that this is someone who had a terrible childhood and loves bullying and humiliating opponents, and basically believed that through a massive show of force by the US and Israel, that Iran would very quickly collapse. And despite the fact that the US military told him it's not going to work that way, he has his own view of reality. You know, it's like, even though he knows he lost the 2020 election, he has altered his thinking in a way that I think he now really believes that he won. And I think that his conception of this war is it's going to make him even a greater person. Now, in the behind the scenes of all of this, there's a combination of factors. There's Christian nationalists, white Christian nationalists, who are looking for Armageddon and their interpretation of the Bible, right? So that's a factor. This is aimed at supporting Israel and Israel's efforts to create greater control over the Western Asia or Middle East. And so there's these factors. I think that David, you're right about, well, actually both of you, in terms of seeking resources that's going on. I think all of those factors, but the problem is there is no plan. And this is one of the things that's rattling mainstream authorities in government, that there is no plan for how this is going to work, how long this will last, and how you bring it in for a landing. So in the middle of all this, you know, he's saying things like the Iranians want to talk peace. The Iranian foreign minister, I just read today, said, no, we never said that. You know, the losses that are being suffered aren't being fully communicated to the people of the United States. So we got all this stuff going on. And it's directly linked to the domestic. And that's what people have to understand, that the MAGA domestic and foreign policies are linked. It's this idea of dominance, brutality, it's masculinist, if you want to use that term, that's all going on and that they want to assert. And it's very dangerous precisely because we have no idea how this is going to end up.
You know, one of the things that that I keep looking at, you talk about a 15-year-old and an 80-year-old body. Most of those folks in there, and I put little Pete in the same category because he seems to think this is some kind of video game. He loves talking about what he's going to bomb, what it's going to do to him, and how it's going to make us feel. He's really sick in that way. And so I'm thinking about the fact that they claim Iran retaliated in the other country. I don't know that that's true because everything these folks say is a damn lie. And so visually, I don't know that that's true because we already said, David, that the CIA has been operating in that region for a very long time, causing mischief and division. And so here you have these other countries that now say, okay, now we got to get involved, whether rightfully or wrongfully, because, you know, somebody's invaded their sovereign land. And so I keep thinking, where is all this going to go? But it certainly is not making the world safer. And the other thing I think about is on this soil, it creates animosity towards people in this country. And this is how we get these lone wolves who decide that they want to do some mass shootings of innocent people. And so this whole thing about Trump's making the world safer, it just seems like it's just the opposite. He's making it more dangerous, more unpredictable, more chaotic.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. It is all of those things. And it is It will necessitate mediation in order for this to be brought in for a landing. There needs to be a third party, and the Omanis had been mediating in the earlier discussions. But you know what further complicates this is that this was a Pearl Harbor assault. I mean, a lot of people don't remember or didn't know that in the lead up to the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States and Japan were in negotiations. And it was the Japanese that decided in the middle of the negotiations, and it was planned to hit Pearl Harbor. That's exactly what Trump has done with Iran twice. In the middle of negotiations, attack. Well, and he did the same thing with Venezuela. So at a certain point, the problem becomes, when can you trust that negotiations are not the prelude to a surprise attack? And this becomes very, very dangerous. Because if a country says, we cannot trust that we won't get attacked, they may launch the first strike. Mm-hmm.
David, you want to jump in?
Yeah, add to that the fact that you can't trust a gangster businessman. I think that's pretty clear. And the one thing that we have in our favor is that no one is supporting this war. I mean, you know, depending on which poll you look at, it might have 20-30% support. And I think that that speaks to the fact that people are old enough to remember when we've been down this path before.
And many times.
Yes, many, many times. But I think, you know, the issue is how soon can we get these people out of office? Because it's pretty clear that, you know, we just can't continue with this. I mean, it's only March.
Well, here's the thing: when there's an invasion and you pull out the leader as he did in Venezuela, and then you say, Who's running Venezuela? And then they say, we are. We who? And so I just can't even talk about it, because what if we think about the reverse, what if somebody came, knocked Trump out the box, bombed a few installations here? People would be like up in arms. But yet the same is not felt when we do it to other. These are sovereign countries, whether we like them or not. None of them have really, you know, done anything to us per se in terms of military actions. And so why is all this venom going, except that it's about the resources? It's about the oil in Venezuela, and here, who's running the country? And if you take out the leader in Iran, and who did you replace it with? Most of the time it's somebody worse, because the people themselves didn't even have a chance to, like, organize and say who they wanted for their leaders. I always think about the Arab Spring. You know, you got something worse than what you anticipated. And so I just think that it just creates a level of chaos that takes decades to undo. And I think when I think about that, I think about Afghanistan. You know, nobody won there. Russia didn't win. The Soviet Union, U.S. didn't win. And so what do we have over there now? People that the U.S. government doesn't like. So it's like a circle. What are we doing? And the money that's going. I mean, they're trying all these new toys and new weapons and all of this. I just keep, are we bankrupting this country for us? Now, they extracting all the money they can. They benefiting like, I don't know what, but what's going to be left for us?
I don't think on a certain level that they care. I was thinking about the destruction of Iraq and how that could have been predicted. It wasn't simply incompetence, although there was a level of that. There was also arrogance and a level of not really caring about what the result would be. I think that they want to see Iran break up. So today I saw a report that the CIA is trying to help the Kurds in Iran carry out an uprising. Now, I feel for the Kurds. Don't get me wrong. The Kurds have been stomped on by the Iranians, the Iraqis, the Syrians, the Turks. But right now, what the CIA wants is to splinter Iran, because that's also what the Israelis want. The Israelis want a divided Iran. Whereas the progressive people in Iran who are fighting and have been protesting against the theocracy, they want a progressive Iran. They're not looking for the breakup of the country.
But David, is that not what they do? The divide and conquer? And when will they learn? I guess we haven't learned in this country because they've been dividing and conquering the class and the different racial groups. But it seems like, particularly in the Middle East, that they would have come up with some kind of unified analysis and assessment of the U.S. First of all, you can't trust them. And second of all, what they've done to the region over the last, really, 100 years.
Yes, very good point. I mean, it's interesting to see how people in the Middle East are being divided the same way they try to divide us. Another thing that I would say is that, you know, just to add to the mix, you know, I think we're witnessing the extinction burst of the U.S. empire. You know, empires are always the most violent at the end. And it seems like we have folks who are trying to hold on to this power. And, you know, I'm hoping that it doesn't work. But another thing, though, is one thing I did not expect was the way that Iran attacked the U.S. bases throughout the Middle East. So you have these states, you know, these client states. I want to see what they're going to do now that they realize that the U.S. does not actually have their back. And it was really all about looking out for Israel's interests. So when you have Dubai blowing up and the rich and famous don't have their spot to, you know, frolic and have their fun, you know,
yeah,
things
yeah.
change.
Yeah. So that's why I said I don't even know if we could definitively say that Iran hit all of those bases in 14 countries. So, but it certainly made them all pay attention. It's like, wait a minute, now you're going to have us have to react just like you had to react. But I certainly didn't think they were going to hit those other bases. I thought they would try to maybe do something here, which has become easier and easier because when you look at the technology, everybody has it. The U.S. has been selling it to everybody. So you can, like, you know, use the sensors and see where the grid is and where the military supplies are. So all of us, I think, are vulnerable in terms of countries. And so I just when I think about 14, the number of hits in those countries and what they're planning to do, which we don't know now. They could be talking now about how they're going to respond, and we just don't know where this is going to end, which I think is the scary part.
I agree. I think it's reasonable to believe that the Iranians hit those military bases. Whether they hit other targets or whether those were false flag operations that were being carried out by the U.S. or Israel, will only time will tell. But I think the Iranians have made clear that if your country had U.S. military bases that were used against us, then it's open season. Now, one thing that I think is really important to add here, Jamala, that David, you mentioned earlier, is that none of this is to defend the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime is incredibly reactionary. It's brutal. I think that some people on the left have forgotten that after the Ayatollah Khomeini came in 1979, that they began jailing and murdering leftists. And then in 1988, there was another wave. Thousands of leftists were murdered by the regime. So this is not a humanitarian regime, not pro-people. But as I said to a group the other day, when some people were saying, well, you know, it doesn't matter whether the current Ayatollah Khomeini is alive or not, he was bad. It's not up to one country to enter in and to take it upon itself to overthrow the government of another one, short of a war of self-defense. And this was not a war of self-defense. This was a war of choice. Trump, Netanyahu had a choice. They, you know, as you said, the agreement that the Obama administration negotiated earlier was a very legitimate agreement that the Iranians were sticking to, and there was no reason to break it up except Israel wanted war, and specifically Netanyahu wanted war, and they got it. They got the war, and it might end up being a war that brings down Israel.
Well, I'm thinking that, you know, the election last night, which was the first of several, particularly those battlegrounds where it could change the face of the Senate and the House. What do you think will be different if the Democrats are in control of both the House and the Senate as it relates to this international stuff?
I think that they'll move to impeach Trump. But I think that it's not going to be enough. And that's where I think people on the ground have to be prepared to act, both in November of this year and then, you know, God willing, in November 2028, that when we see that we have an administration that does not care about the law, my fear is that it will be something like Evil Empire and Star Wars, right? Where the parliament or whatever it was called, right? They could pass all kinds of things, but the emperor basically can decide at a certain point to just close it down, proclaim some sort of crisis and close it down. And we, the people of the United States, have to, under those circumstances, be prepared to act.
Well, last month for the BC roundtable, I had them react to a quote that basically said that Democrats are not going to be much different because they want some of the same things that these elites are getting, the power, the prestige, the money, and all of that. So there's not going to be a significant change, even though they may be more in numbers. And so I think when we start looking at some of these Democrats now, I'd have to be saying, they might have a point there. But, you know, you had Crockett lose, not by a whole lot, but she still lost. And how she lost, to me, still points to the fact that the Democrats don't have a strategy. And they don't have a strategy about who they really want in these positions of power, and the folks that we think ought to be there, apparently they don't. I mean, I think about how long it took Hakeem Jeffries to endorse Mamdani. You know, so they got some stuff going on that maybe we not privy to, but they're not like as bold as they should be given all of the stuff that's going on. And so
be
maybe there's
here.
Truth that they want some of the power, whether it's vested in them or not, because right now they should be, what I think, David and Bill, planning for not only the impeachment, but how do you overturn some of the madness that has already been, some of it you can't get the West Wing back, but what's gonna be the plan to try to normalize stuff by overturning some of the stuff that this fool has done?
Well, see, I think you're gonna be careful though, first of all, the Democrats would not have been doing what Trump is doing. I mean, we should just dispel people of that. That doesn't mean that the Democrats would be perfect or anything else. They wouldn't be doing this. And when people say that, part of what they're doing is that they're not dealing with the fact that we are in an extraordinary situation. So they're trying to act like it's still a Tweedledum, Tweedledee. It ain't. This is an existential fight. So I think we should dispel people of that. And then when we talk about the Democrats, I always say, well, which Democrats? Like you talked about Texas. Frankly, I was for Tallarico. I've been following this guy for years. And I think this guy is really, really interesting. So his defeat in Crockett, to me, I'm not drawing any conclusions from that. I think that there is a struggle within the Democratic Party that's very different than struggles that are currently going on in the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has consolidated as an authoritarian party. The Democrats are in a kind of civil conflict that's going on between different wings. You know, the idiot that you have in Pennsylvania, David, Fetterman, right? I mean, why does he even claim to be a Democrat, right? And then you have the AOCs on the other hand. You know, so I think what's important is that we've got to engage this fight, as opposed to expecting that the Democratic Party establishment is going to resolve this. They're not. We're going to resolve it.
I agree.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think that what we have to look at is accountability and reconstruction. Accountability for everything that has been going on. We have to have tribunals, whatever, and we have to make sure this doesn't happen again. And that's all going to require a massive reconstruction, remodeling of this country and the systems of power. And, you know, if you want to call it an FDR style, you know, type of thing, you know, whatever you want to call it. But my issue with the current Democratic leadership, and I agree with you, Bill, that, you know, we have to look at which Democrats are doing good and which are problematic. As long as they are beholden to the money, these PACs, the lobbyists, AIPAC, military-industrial complex, we will not solve anything. And that's something that we, you know, and like you mentioned Jasmine Crockett, I was listening to an interview she gave when the this reporter was asking her about, you know, her stance on Israel. And she said, well, you know, we've had, the U.S. has had a special relationship with Israel for years before I was born, and we're always going to have this. And that's why I voted to give them more money. And as long as we have the Congressional Black Caucus, you know, getting a chunk of their funding from these problematic, toxic, moneyed interests, it ain't going to work. And I think we have to replace all of the lawmakers who are engaged in this.
Yeah. Well, you talk about AIPAC, the people would periodically say, what's the stance of the Congressional Black Caucus on this? That's, they ain't gonna say a word. They ain't gonna say a peep. Because it's like, oh, they've been quiet. What is their view on this? They ain't got no view, okay?
Right.
Because their view, their tongues have been, you know, tapered and tied by all this lobbyist money. And when you talk about reconstruction, I'm just thinking about what that would look like, because the kind of money that these folks get when they get in Congress, most of the time they go in there already having money, because you got to have big dollars to even win. But even if you don't, you're going to become a millionaire over time. I mean, that. But now we're talking about billionaires. So even if you're a millionaire, you're still a low on the totem pole. But I'm just wondering, from you all's standpoint, what would reconstruction look like? Because I keep thinking there's a lot of work. I mean, there's some easy stuff for sure. You could take his damn name off of the Kennedy Center. Okay, that's easy. But some of this other stuff, it's
See,
so you
that's
have to be really imaginative and a visionary to think about, like, how do we go forward after 2016 to 2018?
So I think if you use kind of the imagery of an onion, the outer skin is the anti-MAGA consensus. And that's a very broad group. And that's like some Republicans, it's Democrats, it's all kinds of people, leftists, right? The next skin are left progressive folks. And it's the left progressive folks that need the reconstruction, a third reconstruction agenda that you're talking about, David. And I think part of that, Jamala, is we need our own version of a 10-point program that is, you know, here are the basic things. And Jack O'Dell, late Jack O'Dell, came up with something called the Democracy Charter 20 years ago along those lines. We need something that very concisely summarizes what we're fighting for. But then we have to talk about both what happens immediately after a Democratic victory in 2028, like a Project 2025. And then we have to be also thinking about operating at multiple levels. In other words, it's not just at the presidential level. We've got to be thinking about the third reconstruction at the municipal and county and state and federal levels. And it's ultimately, it's about expanding democracy. And so in all spheres, we need to be looking at how do we expand democracy, technology, in politics, in the economy, right? In basic civil rights, how do we expand democracy? And I think that would be the indicator as to whether we're moving towards a third reconstruction or whether it's some attempt to return to quote unquote normality.
I don't even know if we know what normality is, because things over time have been normalized that are abnormal and we have gotten used to it. David, what do you say?
Well, I agree with everything that Bill said. And I do think that the political power structure is not going to do jack unless we have a movement of people demanding all of this. And ultimately, we want leaders in power who are going to be from the community, who are going to do what we say. But it's definitely a big mess. And there's so many things I can think of that need to be reformed or just dismantled and, you know, something else built. But I think it's an all hands on deck scenario that we're dealing with. And yeah, this is historic. It's frightening, but it's also exciting at the same time, because, you know, as much as they are dismantling right now, some of it we don't need. Some of it never helped us. And we have to decide, and we have a good opportunity to really look at what it is that we need to make this a true democracy, because it never was one.
Yeah, yeah. So I think for folks like us who believe this is a democratic experiment, that we have to begin articulating it in different ways, because what I'm seeing now is total disillusionment that we are losing the democracy and that these tyrants will be in power forever. Because if they decide by executive order that we can't have an election 2028 because of some national threat that they imagined or, you know, manufactured, what is to be done? And so those scenarios, I think we have to also start thinking about. I'm all for being proactive in visioning so that people understand there's something beyond this, but we can't get through it unless people organize. That's the big thing. You can't be a spectator. You can't be sitting down saying, woe is us. We're going to have to fight and fight like hell. And so in the last few minutes we have left, what are the one or two things that we need to be doing in our communities right now, whether it be with the elected officials or with the people or both, that is going to push us in that direction?
David? One thing I'll say is that this idea of a national strike is something that I can't get off my mind. And I believe that we have to get, you know, maybe not the entire population, but a critical mass of people to start thinking in these terms. You know, people who maybe are not political, and get them to understand what's happening, the reasons why they are so miserable and don't have money for basic things. You know, I think that we need something big like that to really make a change. So that's what's on my mind.
I would say that the most important thing to do right now is in every locale to understand exactly what MAGA is saying about the November elections, to understand that any emergency that destroys the elections will ultimately destroy us, and they will be coming for people. So this is not a time for people to be passive, and that in every location, people need to start planning. Scenario planning for what we anticipate MAGA is going to do or could do, and what should be our appropriate response, and what level of organization we need in order to kick their ass. I mean, basically, I mean, it's not just about studying.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's where I'm looking to, beyond all the chaos that people have to begin believing that there's something new and different. So thank you, my BC brothers, for joining us today. And we're going to continue this conversation wherever we are. This is Jamala Rodgers, your host. I will see you on the battlefield.
Take care.
All right.
do the right thing.
You've got to do it.